This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Did your state vote in one of the Super Tuesday primaries? If not, what are the races and issues you're most concerned about as the general election campaigns start coming into better focus? What candidates are best suited to make a difference in the issues you think are most important? We are taking the temperature of the Native vote today, and we have some perspectives from people keeping an eye on the issues, and we're taking your calls. Coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tuesday's big primary day in the U.S. had victories across the country for both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, leading to a likely rematch in November. While Super Tuesday is over, attempts to boost voter turnout among Native people are underway, including in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM in Milwaukee reports a new mural is part of Get Out the Vote efforts.
The mural now hangs outside the Gerald Ignace Indian Health Center in Milwaukee. The painting features a woman in a jingle dress standing near seven children and reads, "Vote for our seventh generation." At a dedication ceremony, Ho-Chunk artist Christopher Sweet said every election is important.
"And this year, every vote is critical. When I was painting this mural, I thought about my children's futures. But it does not end there. Let's think about all of our future generations."
The celebration of the mural is just the start of Get Out the Vote collaborations this year in Wisconsin, which is a presidential battleground state, and there is divided control of state government. Ann Egan Walkaw of the group Wisconsin Native Vote is a member of the Menominee Nation. She says if there's voter apathy about the race for president, she has not experienced it.
"You know, when I'm out talking to my people, I hear a lot of enthusiasm because they do understand climate change. Do you remember when the Canadian fires were going? We had people literally sick. I got sick down here. But our people see it, and they really know that Mother Earth needs our help. By voting, they can help."
Egan Walkaw says there are plans to work with the Milwaukee Public Schools to register more 18-year-old students to vote. Other Get Out the Vote efforts are planned at tribal communities in northern Wisconsin. There are roughly 70,000 Native Americans of voting age in the state. The last two presidential contests in Wisconsin were decided by only about 20,000 votes. I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Montana Governor Greg Gianforte says the state will not take over law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. That's in response to Lake County saying it's pulling out of a long-standing agreement to do that work. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
It's unclear who will take over felony law enforcement oversight following Gianforte's letter saying the state can't afford it. Lake County Commissioner Gail Decker says the letter raises more questions than answers.
"Who has jurisdiction? Does the county have it? Does the state have it? Does the feds have it? Again, that's a question that is on people's minds and we don't have an answer to it."
In the 1960s, the federal government, the state, Lake County, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes all signed on to a deal called Public Law 280. The deal said Lake County would jail and prosecute people for felony crimes committed on the reservation. But Lake County last year announced it's pulling out because it can't afford the roughly $4 million it costs to oversee felony jurisdiction. Now Gianforte's office says the state also plans to pull out of the agreement. Gianforte says he is initiating a process to give felony jurisdiction to the federal government. It's unclear whether he can do that on his own or needs buy-in from state lawmakers. It's also unclear whether the federal government will agree to take over. The CSKT issued a letter saying it will continue to work with the county and the state to find a path forward. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Super Tuesday is the biggest day of the primary election season, and voting in more than a dozen states increased the chances of a general election rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in November. There were other clues about what voters are thinking in several races around the country, and today we are taking time to discuss election issues impacting Native voters. We'll hear perspectives from people who are keeping their eyes on the issues, but we also want to hear from you. What's on your mind as the presidential race narrows? What other candidates or issues are most important to you? Taxes, the economy, the age of the major candidates, strengthening tribal sovereignty, environmental protection. Take your pick and let us know what you think will make the most difference in local and national elections. Join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848. Those phone lines are open now, so get your calls in early. We'll get your comments on the air. Joining us now, while he's on business in Austin, Texas, is Jordan James Harville. He lives in New York, and he is the National Program Director for the Advanced Native Political Leadership. He is Cherokee and Choctaw. Hello, Jordan, and good to have you back on Native America Calling.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation.
And joining us from Oklahoma, we have Alan Wright. He is the president and founder of the Hustings Group, and he is Choctaw. Hi, Alan, and welcome back to you as well.
Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, Jordan, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. Big night last night, Super Tuesday coverage. Did you stay up late watching all the results come in?
Not too late, but I did see a good portion of them, for sure.
Yeah, I did too. Well, it didn't seem like a whole lot of surprises, at least not among the presidential primaries. But what are your thoughts about what we can glean after Super Tuesday?
You know, the reality is that many of us knew that what was going to be the result of the Super Tuesday contest. I think for many Americans kind of watching this process, that maybe there was a glimmer of hope that we would have a different set of candidates at the end of this. I think what happens in Super Tuesday is it's really about thinning the field and focusing in on the candidates that are going to go the distance. And so, you know, Trump and Biden coming out as folks who have not clinched the nominations yet, but are quite close, and the other folks not, you know, getting close enough to them, is something that I think we kind of expected, but it, you know, now is the attention is going to focus quite clearly on these two.
Mm-hmm. We still have 8 months to go, so a lot can happen. Jordan, what issues do you think are most impacting Native voters right now, and who are you talking to, and what are they telling you?
Sure. So, you know, actually, the First Nations Development Institute with Brookings just released a survey of Native voters. When we start thinking about the differences between, you know, kind of our tribes and as governments, kind of what their priorities are for an administration versus Native peoples, right, which are just everyday folks who are going about their lives in the states. The differences, I think, are interesting. The tribes specifically, as we're starting to think about, you know, what a future administration could look like, I think that there's a really special emphasis on making sure that tribal sovereignty stays a bipartisan issue, that it doesn't become partisanized, it doesn't fall into kind of the trap that so many issues do in presidential nominating contests. What we really want to see is that tribal sovereignty is protected by both parties going forward, and that we're left out of that conversation, so that when it comes time to appoint the next set of justices to the Supreme Court, when we're nominating federal court justices next year, when we're making presidential appointments, that there are folks that are going to be open to the needs of our governments to be able to act for our people. For Native peoples, though, thinking about some of the challenges that were coming up and were surfaced in the survey was, you know, thinking about economic development, jobs. Of course, this is something that's on everyone's mind at the moment, making sure that we have a strong economy, right? I think that we've been in a state of a little bit of a flux with the economy, but it is strong still, and we want to make sure that it stays that way. That particularly impacts Native folks. But also protecting our tribal lands, protecting our water rights and access. We are on the front lines of some of the largest environmental battles in Indian country, particularly on and around tribal lands. And so that's also a top priority for folks. And I want to name the other one that surfaced as a constant conversation, which is the missing and murdered Indigenous women. We have had in peoples. We've had some movement on legislation in the states around this. But the reality is that we still need federal protections and deep investment in making sure that our people are safe. So that's kind of the stuff that's rising to the top of my mind.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about economic development, because nationally, of course, you know, it depends on who you talk to, but a lot of people are pretty optimistic. We've got inflation seems to be in check. You know, we've definitely bounced back from the pandemic. The stock market is roaring, if that's any indication. But what about on the tribal level? What are you seeing in tribal economies? Are they enjoying that same rebound that mainstream businesses and corporations are enjoying across the country?
You know, I think the challenge is kind of a twofold. So, you know, more than 70% of Native peoples live off of tribal lands, right? So much of the economy is actually driven by what the economy of a Los Angeles or an economy of an Austin, right? What that looks like. In that sense, we share the same issues, I think, as other folks, which is we are in a time that, of course, the economy is strong, but we are still challenged by high interest rates, right, which are preventing us and the next generation from becoming homeowners. Native peoples in general, we have many kind of programs through HUD to protect and support us in getting home ownership. But the reality is that we are still fully underrepresented in that category. And then thinking about just things like the cost of food and groceries and gas, and depending on where you're at, right? And so these are the things that I think actually impact people's lives, and the feeling behind the economy, that's where that lives, right? For tribes, though, as they're starting to think about economic development, I think what it really comes down to is building strong kind of rural sectors, right, for ourselves, and building up strong businesses. I think that, you know, when we think about places like Northeast Oklahoma in Cherokee, where my family is from, it is seeing a booming economy, one like that we've never seen really before in that corner of the state. I think that's a story that you'll see a lot in Indian country. And so the reality is that the economy is strong, but there are still some kitchen table issues that are driving people's decisions and making it hard to get by on a day-to-day basis.
Well, let's also talk about some of the other races around the country, specifically states like Michigan, California, and then there in Texas where you're visiting right now. You've got that embattled Attorney General Ken Paxton, and he's endorsed a number of candidates. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. When I'm thinking about it, I'm really looking for what where like the breakouts are. I think for our work under the Native Leadership Institute, it's really about closing the representation gaps at all levels. And so that's the lens in which I look at this. We need about 17,000 Native elected leaders across the country at all levels of government, from school boards to president, in order to reach basic representational parity. And so when I think about, and we currently have about 350 Native elected officials, so that 350 to 17,000 gap is huge. A lot of that will be made up in smaller races at the local level, which I think is an important piece for us to invest in Indian country, so we build the next kind of bench of Native leaders who are going to step up on Native issues. Saying that, in some of the federal races that I've been taking a look at, we're thinking about, you know, obviously Mary Peltola's race in Alaska. This one is a huge piece for us. And thinking about how she won statewide, she's going to have to try to do it again. It's going to be an uphill battle, and there's going to need to be a lot of investment in order to accomplish that. But she's been able to bridge it through her initial messaging and through the setup of her office after the special election. I'm looking at Jonathan Nez's race, the the former head of the Navajo Nation, and he's now running for the Arizona 2nd Congressional District. This is a district that was hit pretty hard by redistricting in the last cycle, and where it was held by Tom O'Halloran for a very long time. That district was blue. It is now leaning red. And so he has a really uphill battle. But I think the thing that I have a special connection to this district in one particular sense is that in 2020, when Yazzie v. Hobbs, the Arizona Supreme Court case that restricted mail-in ballot access on the Navajo Nation, when that decision was made, it structurally disenfranchised the nearly 100,000 Native voters that lived on the nation. There was a massive mobilization campaign across Indian country to make sure that folks were able to exercise their right to vote. And, you know, 100,000 voters, Biden won the state by something like 14,000 votes. They were the deciding factor. And so when I start thinking about Nez's race, it's an animating piece. I'm also looking at Sharice Davids in Kansas as well for her follow-up.
Okay. Well, we keep hearing that, like, especially with the presidential election, it's going to come down to those swing voters, right? And it could be razor thin in some of these different districts. And you mentioned, you know, some of the issues that Native folks have had getting their votes out and being able to vote for their candidate of choice. How confident are you coming up in November that every Native American voter that wants to vote has that opportunity?
You know, I think that it would be, you know, it would be disingenuous to say that that we are not still facing massive voter suppression in Indian country. We're seeing this challenge all over the country. Arizona is a great bellwether for this. There is a ton of investment by Indian country through groups like the Native American Rights Fund, the ASU Native Legal Clinic, to be able to protect those votes. But what we're seeing is it is a constant cycle of, you know, poll workers who may not be educated on how tribal IDs work or how, you know, tribal citizens can access the polls. It'll, you know, still very long distances to the polls oftentimes, even though we've had a little bit of movement on that. There's some strong political education that still needs to happen in Indian country. We see, unfortunately, that from both the Republican and Democratic side, that there's a deep underinvestment in turnout and voter education on tribal lands and in the surrounding areas. And so because of that, right, that we are often left to our own political infrastructure to do that. Saying that, through the work that Advance has done, through the work of so many organizations, Native leaders in the states, we've actually in a different political infrastructure level than we were before. At this point, we are, you know, we have places like Arizona Native Vote, the statewide C3 entity, Indigenous Impact Arizona, statewide C4. We're seeing these types of statewide voter engagement organizations pop up all over across the country in the last 4 years, and that gives me hope.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and we will be back with Jordan James Harville and Alan Wright. We are talking about results from Super Tuesday. Stay with us. A federal judge sided with the Puyallup tribes in February on removal of a dam along the Puyallup River in Washington to restore salmon habitat and populations. And the Biden administration is devoting $1 billion to restoring salmon in the Columbia River system in the Pacific Northwest. We're talking about the latest efforts to protect this important cultural resource. That's on the next Native America Calling.
A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
You are listening to NAC. I'm Sean Spruce. Pundits are deciphering the results from Super Tuesday. Hot topics like immigration, inflation, and the wars overseas are setting the tone for political debates. But so are issues like tribal sovereignty, treaty rights, and addressing income disparities. What political issues are you most concerned about this election year? Let us know. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our next guest, Alan Wright, joins us from Oklahoma, where he's president and founder of the Husting Group. And Alan, thank you again for joining us. And what are your main takeaways from Super Tuesday?
Well, I think I'd go with Jordan. I think if any of us were expecting
surprise or a different outcome. I mean, it wasn't coming. You know, as a political scientist, I'm looking for various cracks in the armor on both sides. And are there any kind of wedge issues or demographics that might cut against the two main candidates in terms of President Biden and former President Trump? And I don't see them. I mean, there were some, you know, no contest or no choice outcomes in the Democratic side. There were a few, you know, I guess Nikki Haley won Vermont and there were a few things. But here in Oklahoma, where Trump won 83-some-odd%, I've been mining the election results and finding a few precincts scattered around in the urban areas where Nikki Haley was able to win and win very narrowly. And, you know, I thought that might have exposed some, you know, kind of old guard Republican versus the populist Republican break that we see now, and it just didn't emerge. I mean, it was a massive victory.
Well, you keep hearing about this massive change in direction from the traditional Republican Party, right? Mm-hmm. And how it's now like the party of Donald Trump. And you're there in Oklahoma, and that's a heavy red state. Are you seeing that same dynamic play out there amongst the Republican Party, or is it a little different?
No, it is. I mean, it's his party. I'll let people decide whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, there are a number of us who started in Oklahoma as Republicans when you could fit all of us in a phone booth. It was fairly small back during the Reagan years. Now it's, you know, a deep red state. But Oklahoma has always had a populist strain. We have the most populist state constitution in the country. And those voters, and we've seen this nationally, those voters have migrated back and forth, right, between the Democratic and Republican parties. And I think they've found a home now back with Donald Trump's Republican Party. He speaks to and seems to represent, in spite of his, you know, wealth and other stature, seems to try to represent the working class.
Well, the polls are pretty close. I just read that Donald Trump does appear to be leading in quite a few major polls, though, but close, very close, single digits. Biden beat Trump once. What do you think's going to have to change for that outcome to be different this year in 2024?
Well, Biden has a record as president, and so, you know, the Trump campaign has that to run on, where, you know, we rolled out of COVID and the result of the disruption, you know, in the summer leading up to the presidential election. And Trump was very much on the defensive. And so, you know, Biden was effective. And I mean, this is a tactical compliment at avoiding all of that. And now he's got a record, right? A track record to run on. He certainly brings forward his accomplishments, but there are a number of things that are concerning for the public that the Trump campaign will be able to exploit and draw a contrast between the two terms. I mean, it really is a historic election in terms of having a former president and a current president running against each other. So, you know, we have that to enjoy for the next 8 months or so. But, you know, the economy's different now than it was years ago, but structurally, you know, I think the abortion question is the one that just lays out there in suburban America that Trump's going to have to worry with. Immigration and the troubles that we're having at the border, you know, I don't know if that balances out the other issue, but it certainly creates problems across the country that aren't even in border states where people are concerned about it. So tactically, the Democratic Party turns voters out much better than the Republican voters. Republican Party does. The early votes, the Democratic Party owns early votes in a very significant way. And we'll see tactically if the RNC and the Trump campaign can come up with a Republican version of that. If not, they're going to have some troubles.
We always hear that young voters just don't come out in the numbers that candidates need. And what do you think there in Oklahoma Alan, amongst young Native voters. Are they active voters? Do you think they'll get out and hit the polls come November?
Well, that's the white whale that we all chase, right? Politically, I'm sure Jordan can speak to that too. I don't know. I don't know what's going to motivate them. In the COVID years, there was a lot of fear and concern and the unrest and everything else that I believe, you know, weighed heavily on younger voters. You know, where are they now? Are they, you know, not able to buy a house and food prices are high? You know, what's going to turn them out? I would guess or suspect that it will return to norms. I don't see something that's going to drive them out in a greater way than what we've seen in the past.
Well, let's also talk about, you know, the big national issues that tribal citizens in Oklahoma are most focused on. The people that you're talking to, the people that you're working with, Native folks, Native voters, what are they most dialed into?
I think they're the macro issues, the economy. I don't know that we can draw a distinction between non-Native and Native voters in Oklahoma. And most Native voters, particularly in the Choctaw Nation, which I'm very familiar with, are very conservative, and they're going to support candidates that you know, may or may not be full supportive of Native rights because of these broader issues about the economy, about national defense, national security, immigration, and such. Those weigh heavily on voters' minds in Oklahoma, and I don't draw a distinction between Native and non-Native in that regard.
Now, you mentioned the Choctaw Nation conservative. There's, you know, a large number of tribes there in Oklahoma.
Yes.
And where do most of them fall in? I mean, are they mostly conservative, or would you kind of describe them as maybe more purple? What's the overall political climate there amongst tribal nations in the state of Oklahoma?
It's a blend, and I don't want to label particular friends or specific tribal entities. There are some that lean more Democratic, but by and large, they're a reflection of their constituents. And tribal leaders are, and in Oklahoma, it's a predominantly Republican state. Now, tribal leaders and certain tribal leaders and tribal councils and such, you'll see a more progressive bent to them because they're active in Native issues across the country and elsewhere. But it pretty much tracks what the rest of the state is.
Well, we saw that huge effort of Cherokee Nation, Choctaw Nation mm-hmm. as well, really, you know, denouncing Governor Stitt, hardline Republican, but also a member of the Cherokee Nation. Do you think, is there any sense going forward that any of those tensions or any of those conflicts are going to ease, or is that just going to be, are we going to just have to sit back and just let this one play itself out?
It's going to have to play itself out. That political cake is baked. There have been some incremental positive trends. The Chickasaw Nation recently signed a compact on cigarettes and license tags, and I think you'll find the other large tribes follow suit. So that's a positive thing. But you know, the fundamental relationships and disagreements on tribal sovereignty in the current administration won't change, unfortunately. And it's, you know, it's not viewed as a positive. It's viewed as a negative from a state standpoint. And I don't see that changing until another governor comes in. But we do see very positive response to tribes and tribal sovereignty and cooperation, both in public opinion polls. The state legislature has been very open and willing to work with tribes, and that's provided a nice counter to what we see with the state's chief executive. But yeah, this deal will have to run its course.
Well, we've heard so many articles and reports of, you know, Governor Stitt just really cracking down hard against tribal sovereignty. Can you point to any accomplishments or any policies that Governor Stitt has pushed that have been good for Indian nations in Oklahoma, been supportive of Indian issues?
Specifically for tribes, no. He has done some things in education reform, and that would be a philosophical debate whether or not that's positive or negative. That would apply to rural Oklahoma and rural education that some believe are positive reforms. So again, that's kind of a macro thing, but there is no outreach or anything that I've seen that you could point to in this administration that would directly benefit tribal sovereignty, tribal nations. It just doesn't exist.
Alan, let's talk more about those cigarette and license plate tags, those tribal compacts. How are overall, is that issue moving through the Oklahoma State Senate?
Well, currently, fortunately, there's no need for state legislative action at this point. The state Senate overrode several of the governor's vetoes to extend these compacts for another year. And then, the Chickasaw Nation was able to get, to the table with the governor and reach basically almost a redo of the previous compacts, to which then the other large tribes in eastern Oklahoma and the reservation said, all right, well, let's do the same. And so I think you'll see that follow suit. And not to get in too much detail, but I think the big sticking point was that the governor wanted to confine cigarette sales to kind of pre-McGirt jurisdiction, the pre-McGirt definition of Indian country, which from a practical standpoint is pretty much where cigarette sales take place. I mean, what most of the tribes were concerned about is that they didn't want to adopt a new definition of Indian country, and they've resolved that issue, and I think people are pretty comfortable with operating within that confine, so it doesn't change the McGirt definition of Indian country. It just says, all right, we're going to sell cigarettes within tribal trust land, tribal property, which is how it's been for the last 25 years or so.
And the tribal license plate tags, I go to Oklahoma periodically, and I'm always marveling. It just seems like just every tribal nation there has their own tags. It's really cool when you're driving around the turnpikes and you see all the native cars buzzing along. But I'm curious, what percentage do you know, or the number of tribes in Oklahoma that have their own tags?
No, I don't think I could answer that. You've got the five tribes that obviously are the most prominent because of the large membership base. But I do see, I lived in Cheyenne, Oklahoma, and the Cheyenne Arapaho have tribe plates, and the Ponca, and a lot of the smaller tribes have them too.
Yeah, some of them are just so beautiful too. I love the artwork. And what is it about having their own tags? How does that benefit a tribal nation and tribal citizens to be able to just have their own tribal tags as opposed to the regular state ones?
Oh, it's an expression of our sovereignty, and the great thing about sovereignty and the frustrating thing about the debate about it, it's about jurisdiction. Sovereignty is about citizenship, and as Native Americans, we're dual citizens, right? And so, what better expression of citizenship than, a license tag? I mean, that's, states have them and tribal nations have them. And it's a great affinity for us. And I, as a political advocate too, I wonder every time I see a Choctaw plate pass by me or I pass by them, did they do that because it's cheaper, or are they doing it because they want to align with the Choctaw Nation? And are they, are they an advocate? Are they, just proud of their heritage? I'd like to unpack that at some point.
I would too. Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm always kind of curious, and it just amazes me, how many Native people are in the state of Oklahoma too. Because those plates are everywhere. Let's take a caller now, Chanupa, who's listening on Keeley Radio in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Hello, Chanupa. Did you watch Super Tuesday yesterday?
Yes, I did too, man. Thank you for asking that question. To the brother there that's talking about, the jurisdictions and sovereignty about voting rights, South Dakota's group there, some of the local citizens were taken this challenge on to do away with the ballots, like, you know, electoral ballots and so forth, by showing a group of hands. Now, these things are prompted from what this country symbolically represents, because they have 4th of July labeled as Independence Day. Well, this country of mine, you know, I don't like that crash term America. I like the real term, Turtle Island. Turtle Island has always had a different political outlook when it comes to native rights and stuff that go on in Indian country. But in reality, a majority of them don't see the whole aspect of what's going on. And so what's happening today is that people don't see that these electoral measures cause this problem. And so now that all this stuff that's going on in Indian country, you will see that they're trying to enable natives not to vote so Trump can get back in. South Dakota did that. That's why my tribe, the Oglala Sioux tribe, barred Kristi Noem from coming in. And she's a leading candidate to run with Trump in that primary election that's going to come out, if it ever goes that far. But I like the idea of show of hands. And I think that's one of the questions we need to say. Like they say in Lakota, Na peki ni ta piki le wo suta ai kwake. And thank you for that question. And that brother that's really looking at all these measures, think about it from an independent structure. Freedom and independence is the way you really put somebody in office. Back to you, Sean, and thank you for taking my call.
All right, freedom and independence, Chanup. I really appreciate that call. We're going to take another break here, and we come back, we're going to talk more with our guests, Jordan Harville and Alan Wright, about Super Tuesday and just other issues that are impacting natives this election cycle. So stay with us. Our phone number here at the studio, 1-800-996-2848. Would love to get some more calls going. Would love to hear from Native people in other parts of the country, in Alaska, California, Arizona, North Dakota, all these stations. Give us a call.
Pursuing a degree in higher education is attainable, and with a scholarship from Native Forward Scholars Fund, it is more affordable. From aerospace to veterinary medicine, as the largest direct scholarship provider to Native students in the U.S., Native Forward has empowered over 22,000 students from over 500 tribes in all 50 states in pursuit of their undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees. Info and applications at nativeforward.org. Who support this show.
You have attuned to NAC, and I'm Sean Spruce. We're talking about politics today. 13 states wrapped up their primary voting yesterday, also called Super Tuesday. One prominent presidential contender has dropped out of the race. Meanwhile, congressional candidates confront big issues like immigration and foreign wars. We're making our way through those issues today, and there's still time for you to join us. What candidate or party do you think will best serve the needs of Native American people and our communities? Share your thoughts. Let us know. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. And we've got Alan Wright on the line right now. He's in Oklahoma. And Alan, another topic we just have to talk about today is Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, who is an Oklahoma senator there. He's a member of the Cherokee Nation. And there was big news a while back. He physically challenged a union official there in a Senate hearing to take it outside. And it got really, really tense, and old Bernie Sanders had to jump in and kind of break it all up. But what was the follow-up there? Was there any backlash in Oklahoma for that, or did it actually help his credibility? I'd like to know.
Oh, a little bit of both, I think. It kind of depends on what precinct you might hang out in. And I say this as a proud Oklahoman. There's a lot of people in Eastern Oklahoma where I grew up, that's how they settle problems. And so that just seemed very normal and straightforward in terms of dealing with conflict. And probably the more urbane areas of Oklahoma scratch their head. But Mark Wayne and that union guy had been going back and forth for months about various things. So that, it just kind of came to a head, didn't it? It was fun to watch Bernie try to be the peacemaker there.
Yeah, that would have been something if Bernie had to get in there. Because Mark Wayne, he's a former college wrestler, MMA fighter. I wouldn't want to tee off against that guy in an alley, I'll tell you what. Well, Alan, let's talk a little bit more about Congress and, you know, some of these Native elected representatives. How safe are those seats for those folks going forward, do you think?
Within the Oklahoma delegation?
Yeah, specifically some of these conservative Oklahoma congressional officials.
I think it's still difficult to unseat an incumbent Republican. And we've got, you know, conservatives in the delegation that have, you know, good support. I mean, we do have people with a long, long tenure. And, you know, with the current kind of anti-incumbent and, you know, the drain the swamp viewpoint, you'll find people that will, even in spite of the success of various members who are chairmen of committees and have influence, you know, people might think they've been there too long, but they still win re-election, you know, in solid majorities in the 60s. But there's, you know, the grassroots are certainly animated this cycle. So I wouldn't take anything for granted.
And that Native representation from Oklahoma, do you think it's influencing or maybe changing the understanding of Native issues in Congress, just, you know, having such a large presence like that?
Yes, I do. And I the McGirt decision certainly has brought forward tribal sovereignty and the importance of, you know, the trust relationship that the federal government has and the role that Congress plays. And so if you weren't well-schooled in Indian law and policy from Oklahoma, you should be by now.
All right. Well, Alan, thanks a lot. I'm going to go ahead and pivot back to Jordan, but please stay on the line with us. You know, we still have a lot more to talk about. And Jordan, let's talk a little bit about, you know, these swing issues, these swing voters and Native voters, perhaps, who could potentially sway the election in any way. What are some issues do you think that candidates need to be really mindful of if they want to win those extra Native votes out there in some of these districts around the country?
You know, I think that first, like what I would say is I often talk about this in our own trainings and in the Native Leadership Institute is that, you know, in 2024, the concept of a swing voter is a little bit mythical. That in 1992, when Clinton ran for president, you know, he ran on some Republican issues as well and used Republican talking points, tough on crime, right? Getting back into the economy and focusing on the economy. Like, these are things that are important, of course, to everybody. But the reality is that we don't live in that environment anymore. About 7% of voters in the U.S. are vote switchers. So they might vote Republican one time and Democrat another. And that's on both sides. So it's about a wash. Most folks are pretty ideologically centered at this point. And so I would name that first and foremost. I think when we're thinking about my advice to any candidate out there who's trying to seek the Native vote is – talk about Native issues, yes, but actually talk to Native voters. I think one of the challenges that we see is, you know, in our previous research, looking back from 2010 to 2020, that over 50% of Native voters said that they'd never been contacted by a political campaign, not a phone call, not a direct mail piece, not a knock on their door, right? And the reality is that for anyone who lives in a swing state, they know that that's almost impossible. You can't escape the amount of advertising and money that's going into elections. But in Indian country, often we are. And the reason is because candidates are not courting our votes in the way that they need to. We are the significant, kind of a significant voting block that is a determining factor in so many races in swing states in places like Arizona and the Tester race in Montana, right? And so when we're thinking about this, like, the core issue is go talk to Native voters, talk to them about the issues that matter to them. It probably won't be super surprising, but in the course of that, let's actually create policy solutions that are focused on Native peoples. The reason why we do the work that we do under the Native Leadership Institute is because we genuinely believe that your lived experience is your expertise. And having lived in the policy failures of a government, you then have the best viewpoint or vantage point to be able to suggest the solutions, right? That's why we want Native leaders to run, because they know the value of talking to our people and they know the issues that our people are facing. But for those who are not Native and running and trying to court Native communities, the first step is to go and talk to them, which is happening too little on both sides.
Jordan, you know, you mentioned these vote switchers, and we hear the term, you know, undecided, and you mentioned it's a very slim percentage of voters that are undecided. And it just amazes me, really, with the stark differences between these presidential contenders that we have. How can anyone still be undecided at this point? I'm not really getting it.
Yeah, I think that undecided is a little bit of a misnomer. I think the reality is that, you know, we have projections internally when we run campaigns about where people are going to land ideologically. This is not so much about changing people's mind. There's different schools of thought about this in political strategy. My opinion, and one that I firmly hold, is that you're not really going to change people's minds about the day-to-day lives that they live, right? But what is going to happen, and I think the X factor in all of these races, is turnout. The question is who is voting and who is showing up to make their voice heard. Indian country is trying and has a deep legacy of this, and we also have the deepest legacy of voter suppression. Same with the Black community, same with Latino communities, right? And so when we think about that, the X factor really is where are we placing investment to make sure that communities are heard and that our democracy is truly representative. So the question is really, how do we get those folks out? Less about changing people's minds who have already set in their ways, essentially. They may not say that they're voting for Trump. They may not say they're voting for Biden. When it comes time to cast the vote, I can tell you with 93% certainty that we probably know which way most voters are going to vote when they get there.
All right. Let's take another caller, Michelle, who is listening on station KWSO in the state of Oregon. Hello, Michelle, and what did you think of Super Tuesday?
Well, I wasn't very surprised about how this race is narrowing down, and of course, in key states, and this is a very pivotal time on the national presidential race that many people focus on, but my comment, and would love to get a feedback from from your speakers about the following. You know, truth be told, I used to work in the United States Senate about 25 years ago, and probably more like 30. And in those days, Indian Affairs was either nonpartisan or bipartisan. It was primarily how do we get things done and work together. And I worked on both sides of the aisle for both the Democrats as well as the Republicans, and ultimately the Democrats in the end. And the thing about it now is, you know, there's so much emphasis on the presidential electoral race. However, I think what's happening now and should be also a part of the broader strategy is talking about not only the 435 members in the House, U.S. House of Representatives, but also the 100 members in the Senate. That is the oversight committee, for the oversight arm to the executive branch. Those folks are the ones that have the power. But honestly, now you take it down to like what a local Republican strategy is right now, and you're seeing it is working at the local level, cities, counties, municipalities, states, school boards. You're seeing this happen at the local level and working outwards. It's as if anchoring in these local communities and laying out the ideologies. And it's a lot more toxic. It's a lot more partisan than it ever was. And I think the reality is Indian country in Alaska and natives on the reservation, off the reservation, need to be aware of how important the power of the vote is. It's all rooted in relationships. And I just wanted to find out from your speakers if they are understanding that perspective, and also to what efforts are afoot in education out there in the community, old school communications in person and online about this strategy, and what are some of the efforts to offset that. Washington State to the north here is doing an amazing, they were the first that really did this back in the 90s with Slade Gorton. Tim Johnson in South Dakota, Indian vote in South Dakota, turned that race around and changed the Senate by a little over 300 votes. Mm-hmm. We've seen the power of the Native vote, but what are we doing today? Because this is a huge year. Thank you very much.
All right, that's a great call. Really appreciate that, Michelle. And I'm going to let both of our guests respond to that. Jordan, you first. I think the key takeaway here is the importance of encouraging and educating Native people to exercise their right to vote. What's being done to continue that effort?
You know, in 2016, when Advance was founded, we weren't able to answer some really basic questions about political strategy in Indian country. You know, what is the voter registration rate really? What is the voter turnout? What does partisan identification look like? How many Native elected leaders and candidates are there? And so much of the work that we have done has been really focused on developing the ecosystem of Native leaders and organizations that are going to carry that long-term engagement. Because it's not 2024 is the most important election of our lifetime, sure, and 2028 will be the next one, and 2026 and 2030, right? And so when we think about this, how do we build durable power? The question is really about the organizations and institutions that carry that. In places like Arizona, there wasn't a statewide C4 organization that was Native-led until this year. We helped seed that organization, Indigenous Impact Arizona, and lift up an incredible leader in Brian Garcia, who's Pascayaki there. Janie Parrish turned her organizing operation on the Navajo Nation into Arizona Native Vote, which is now a statewide C3 organization in places like Arizona. That didn't exist in the last cycle, and it exists now. So many of the organizations in Indian country are new, right? They're 2016 to 2020 have all been founded in there. We're talking about Nevada Native Vote and California Native Vote, which, you know, I'll plug this for California. One of our co-founders, Chrissy Castro, is also the founder of California Native Vote. She's Diné and Chicana. And the work that they have been able to do is, you know, taking at one point, the census said, you know, 700,000 Native voters in the state of California, one of the largest in the country. It's now 1.4 million because of the census advocacy. And now those folks are on the map for us to be able to engage. That's the work of long-term organizing institutions that carry us from voting to issues, which I think is the most important part here. It's not just about voting. It's also about year-round issue education, making sure voices are heard to their representatives, and then turning activists into leaders who are running for office as well, or running these organizations. That's the game. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Jordan. And Alan, back to you. And what would you like to say with regard to our caller, Michelle? Because she seemed to touch on some of these same talking points you had with regard to this focus on macro issues for Native voters.
Right, right. Well, I mean, we all breathe the same air and operate in the same economy, and you know, those distinctions, you know, that affect all of us. But I think particularly within the Choctaw Nation, and I know some of the other larger tribes, that there's a focused effort on leadership development, finding people who are either already involved in a city council or a school board or want to be, and facilitating that, helping them, you know, get the training they need, the support that they need to be engaged community members who also happen to be Choctaw or Cherokee or, you know, a native. And so I think encouraging that participation at the local level, and the caller was right. I mean, that's where a lot of change occurs, and influence can be very, very powerful at the local level. So I see that a lot.
Alan, I got one more question for you as we wind down the show. For any listeners here, let's say you've got a Republican and you've got a Democrat and they're living in the same household. Any advice for how those folks can get through the next 8 months?
Oh, love can conquer all.
There you right? go. Love. I sure hope it can. I sure hope it can. Jordan, how about you? Mixed political loyalties in the same household. What do we do?
Some really frank conversations and maybe some strong liquor, too.
Okay. Well, with that, we are out of time, folks. So really appreciate both of our guests who joined us here today for coverage of Super Tuesday, Jordan James Harville and Alan Wright. And I sure hope you'll tune in to NAC again tomorrow for an update on protecting salmon in the Pacific Northwest. Hope you'll join us. I'm Sean Spruce.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888- Art Fake. Support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
Ah, chess bookani, spoos bookani, lia toi. Nequets ethan to chess the ethan, nequets quacum in su, une quin cremals, mhets just in tell, suas boos. Sellant suan puch bohoot, etis chen suas in quellus mammies. Chuckle telsent suan in quellus such mariam, quil nefts me. Quist coim at healthcare.gov, uquach quilquil telsent 1-800-318-2596. Yets mammeet and centers quil Medicare u Medicaid services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.